VentureCast.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
At Baker's, no matter where you order free pickup, you get the same great deals as you'd get in-store. So you can save when you order during band practice, or at the dog park, or wherever. Start your cart with the Baker's app and save from wherever today. Baker's, fresh for everyone. $35 order minimum, restrictions may apply. Subject to availability.
Get more ways to save at the buy five or more, save $1 each sale. Just buy five or more participating items and save $1 each with card. Baker's, fresh for everyone.
Hello, and welcome to the Social Psychic Radio Show, featuring Jason Zook. In uncertain times, we must change our focus and priorities. This show will highlight social justice issues with the goal of expanding minds and increasing unity, love, and mutual respect for ourselves and our planet. We support the Black Lives Matter movement. Our show aspires to promote social spirituality, which simply means that by coming together, we can solve any of our problems, including the goal of bringing an end to all forms of hate, discrimination, bias, or oppression. We must protect our environment, reform our criminal justice system, and protect every citizen from police brutality. When we come together, it becomes possible to bridge the gaps that plague our society and divide us from within. We the people means everyone.
Hello and welcome to the Social Psychic Radio Show. It's a great pleasure that I have the opportunity of presenting special guest Glenn Tickle to the show today. Glenn is a comedian and a weird dad based in New Jersey. His special The Favorite is available now on Dry Bar Comedy, and his previous special, Good Grief, a comedy about loss and being bad at it, is available on Amazon. Glenn's also the publisher of Jerk the Magazine, a magazine you can send to people you don't like. It's a great pleasure. I welcome Glenn to the show. Welcome to the show, Glenn.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. I appreciate us being able to have this opportunity to do this episode today and share your story with our audience. Let me ask you this. I want to ask you, how did you start out with comedy? Because I'm always fascinated by comedy, because for me, I don't tell jokes well. I suck at it. I wish I could. I've always screwed up punchlines. I've stuttered along telling the story. I'm not good at telling a joke. And so when
I did it once in college, because I've been interested in it for as long. Like, I remember watching the Steve Martin episode of The Muppet Show on repeat because my grandparents had it on tape when I was a kid. I would watch anytime it was on TV, as like VH1 used to run old like 80s and early 90s stand-up showcase shows all the time, and I would watch those. I tried it once in college without preparing anything, and like, it went bad, because that's what happens when you don't put effort into it. And then it was years went by before I tried it again, and it was mainly because I went to school for film. But when you graduate, you can't use the school's film equipment anymore. So like, I didn't have really a creative outlet. Like, I didn't have a way to keep making my own movies. So I'm like, well, I see a lot of comedians are getting hired for writing jobs that I'm getting passed over for. So if that's like a way that I can get these jobs, like, I don't mind standing in front of a crowd. I know how to write a joke. Like, I'll just go do that. And then I started finding local open mics in the area. It worked. Like, I've gotten writing jobs out of it, but doing stand-up, I think I would much, I prefer that to getting a writing job at this point.
What is it about stand-up? Because I look at stand-up and I'm like, wow, you're able to walk in front of a group of people, live mic, and work that crowd, right? And to most people, they probably fear that, first off, fear of going in front of a crowd, right? I can talk in front of a microphone for a podcast. If you get me up in front of a crowd that sings karaoke, I'm going to look at you like a deer in headlights.
I'm terrified of doing karaoke. I'll do stand-up for any size audience without concern at all, but I'm singing in public is like my biggest.
So that's what I wanted to ask you is like, what's it like that first open mic night that you show up and you're like, here I am. What was that like for you?
I went, so the open mic that I went to when I decided to like try comedy in earnest, I went to it. It was every 2 weeks at a local bar. So I went one night without intending to go up. So like, I'm going to go watch. And when people tell me they're thinking about getting into stand-up comedy, I tell them to do, I'm like, just go to a local open mic. Like, don't sign up, just watch it. And then you can come back the next time and go up. Because the thing about open mic comedy is a lot of it's quite bad. Like, if you're worried that you're not going to be good, if you watch a local open mic, almost certainly you're going to be like, well, I can do better than a lot of that. Like, it'll build your confidence to watch the whatever local comedy show you have. I will specify open mic. Like, if you just go to a local booked comedy show, they might be great. Like, that might not necessarily help your confidence. But because even open mics, like, you can be good at comedy and have a bad set at an open mic because it's not the best venue for comedy. Like, it's not supposed to be. Bars will agree to host open mic nights because they think it's cheap entertainment, but it's really barely entertainment. Like, it is for the benefit of the comics trying to work new bits. It's not really intended
testing it
audience.
Out. It's like testing out your product before you actually set it off, right? You send it out.
Right.
And I'm looking at open mic. And as I said, I've been to local comedy clubs before COVID was here in Tampa. Like, we would go to different places and I've always had such a great time anytime I do live comedy to watch. Anyone who ever stands up on that stage, I find like when they get to the stage where they go get professionally booked, I feel like they hone their craft so well that they can say certain things that can make most people in the audience laugh. I want to ask you this from your perspective, when you've done your performances, have you had those moments where you tell a joke and half the audience looks at you like you're crazy and the other half like laughs a little, but doesn't really reflect? Like, what do you do with those jokes that just don't really land very well? Do you move on to the next one right away? Or do you kind of like, how do you?
It depends. If it's a joke I really believe in, I will explain it. I like, jokes are always funnier when you have to explain why they're funny to the audience. But I'll usually work a little harder to try to get the rest of the audience on board. I have a pretty extreme example of this. So I do a lot of college shows.
Okay.
And I did one in Maryland, and for some reason it was in a big auditorium. I think it was like the day after the school closed for a snowstorm, so like there weren't a lot of people, but one side was all the students and the other side was a bunch of faculty and like admin. Because
there's a crowd of work.
there was a woman who worked at the college whose last name was also Tickle. So when she saw that I was coming, she got like all her coworkers to go. It's usually like just at college shows, it's just students, maybe one or two.
Yeah.
Administrator, like whoever organizes the student activities group. But this was like a pretty even split of students and adults. But they sat, one side was students, one side was adults. And I do a joke where I sell it to the, I explain to the audience, I'm like, I'm going to tell you guys the dirtiest joke that I've ever written. And it's just a joke about making pancakes for my daughter. And the punchline to it is my daughter asks, she's like, did you eat the D, daddy? Are you still hungry? Eat two D's. And she keeps going on and on like that. And the students are laughing very hard at it because they know what the D is. And the grownups have no idea. So it's the one side of the room is losing it. And the other side is literally like looking over at the other side of the room, trying to figure out what is funny about this man in his mid-30s shouting the D over and over again.
You had the biggest inside joke in the audience where half the crowd got it and the other half just didn't.
Yeah, I'm like, there's an age limit for who knows what you're talking about if you tell someone to eat the D.
And I'm sure that'll be reflected in our audience. People who listen to this, yeah. We'll all get it right away.
I was gonna explain it, but now I'll let them fight it out.
Let's do that as a tickle for them. Yeah. No pun on your word, Google it. Right? You gotta Google it.
You should have safe search on when you Google it.
I love that. I want to ask you this. What's been the best moment for you as a comedian?
This is an easy one. So when I recorded my album when was it? 2016? Yeah, I think it's been 5 years. In 2016, I recorded my first album and I was doing a joke where, so I used to be a substitute teacher, and one day as a sub to kill time with a preschool class, I tried to teach them a knock knock joke.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
And this little three-year-old girl like volunteered. She wanted to get up and tell a knock-knock joke. So normally when I do the story, like I have someone in the audience, I was like, all right, you're going to be this little girl. So take the mic and just repeat what I tell you. And then I tell them the knock-knock joke and they say it to the audience. But my daughter was 3 at the time. So I explain, I'm like, normally I have an audience member come up to pretend to be this 3-year-old, but I have a 3-year-old now. So then my daughter comes on stage and I hold her and she tells the joke into the microphone. And that's the best moment I've had.
I love that. I wouldn't doubt if your daughter doesn't pick up more comedic stuff in the future from your artistic stuff. I feel like she's very creative herself.
We'll see. She does not think I'm funny at all.
Well, how old's your daughter right now?
Now, I have an 8-year-old and now I have another 3-year-old.
Okay.
But, the 8-year-old when she told the joke. Yeah. She, before everything shut down, one of the last shows I did was another college show in Connecticut that I brought her to. It was an overnight trip. She was super excited to get to stay in a hotel. The students gave her coloring books and crayons when we got there. So during the show, she's sitting right up front, just coloring away, completely ignoring me. Could not care less that there was a show going on. Anytime I tried to do jokes at home, she just doesn't like it.
That's interesting you say that. It's like, I want to ask you about this. So you're creative and you're an artist. You know, a lot of people will dissect comedians, painters, sculptors, whatever, right? Writers. That's all different entities. For me, I kind of say in my mind that if you have a creative spark, and you have this ability to make something that's an art form. We're all artists, right? That's how I look at it. So as an artist, I want to ask you this question because this is something I can reflect on. Now you have your show and it's out there and you probably talk to your family about it and you're like, hey, I created this thing. It's out there. Have you ever had anyone in your family and you love them to death and you know who they are, that you show something that you've created and you're proud of it because you're like, this is something I put out there. And then they either don't respond to it or they look at it like, okay. Like, have you ever had that flat response from a loved one in your life about something you put out there that you're really proud of and you've gotten great feedback from other people, but then you have a family member or someone you're like, well, yeah, that's great. You know, I already expect you to do this.
I had to try to explain what Jerk the Magazine was to my mother.
To your mom?
And yeah, she did not understand it at all. Because I was down at my parents' house and my dad, it had just come out, the first issue, and my dad asked how it was going. I was like, oh, it's doing surprisingly well. Like, I had to order a second run from the printer and I had a bunch of orders to ship out. And my mom's like, but what is it again? And I'm like, it's a magazine that you send to people that, like, people pay me to send it to people they don't like. Like, why would they do that? And she's like, well, because then they go to their mailbox and they open it up and it's a magazine all about what a jerk they are. And she's like, that's not nice. I'm like, no, it's not supposed to be. It's the whole point is you just, like, if you have a neighbor who doesn't cut their grass frequently enough, or what, like send it to them. And then they don't know who it's from. They just know they've done something in their life that made somebody want to pay a comedian in New Jersey to create a magazine just to send it to them. And she didn't understand why anyone would want to do that. She didn't understand why I put the work in to make a dumb magazine.
It's your artistic expression.
Yeah. I'm like, it's because I've been home a lot in the past year and a half, Mom. There's not been a lot of comedy shows going on. I needed something to do. And this is how I decided to spend my time.
I say that, and I love my mother to death, but I talk to her about my show and she's like, oh, that's nice. Sometimes she'll listen. Oh, that's nice. Like, yeah, it's funny because sometimes I know my mom supports me. I just know that sometimes family members don't always react the way you would. Sometimes I have something I create, whatever it is. I'm like, hey, I really want someone to like give me some honest feedback. And then I'll share it with them. And they're just like, what a thumbs up, which is good. But I'd like to have some input. I'm sure you're like that too. You want some feedback for when you do your show, or what has it been like for you to get feedback in your life? How's that been in terms of your own flow with people in your life?
Well, that's one of the things that I like about stand up, especially, is that the feedback is immediate. Like if I think of a joke, like I can get on stage that night and tell it. I don't have to, I went to school for film. So it can be literally years between writing a script and seeing the finished movie with an audience to get really proper feedback. Because you can show people a script and it's, you know, helpful to get feedback from people who understand how scripts work. But like, if you give your mom a screenplay, your mom's probably gonna be like, sure, this is fine. I don't know. Unless your mom works in the film industry.
I guess I want to ask you this. How about doing comedy skits about family members? How has that been for you in terms of the ability of expressing your artistic flow to commemorate?
Well, I think since I started doing jokes about having kids, they landed a lot better than jokes I was telling before that. So I've been doing comedy for, I think, 12 years. Yeah, I started in 2009, I think. And before, I would do like weird, a lot of jokes about how I used to be a substitute teacher, or at the time I was still a substitute teacher. Dumb jokes about my name, weird science, like abstract jokes.
Weird science?
Which were all like working fine.
Yeah.
But then when I started talking about having a kid, those jokes worked a lot better. So I just leaned into that. And now I did an interview recently and somebody asked how I write jokes. I'm like, I just wait for my kids to do something funny or terrifying and I tell people about it, which is only a slight exaggeration. Like, so much of my material now is about my kids, and it's because it works. I think it's Ray Romano who said that like an audience will tell you what kind of material they want to hear from you. And I think it's true. Like, if I went out on stage and started doing like really vulgar, like edgy stuff, I don't know that audience would like it. I wouldn't. I know that. But
like an Andrew Dice Clay kind of thing where we're like, younger.
Yeah, like, I think I just come across as just a dad who wants to tell you about his kids. Like, I think that's the vibe I give off. So that's kind of what audiences expect from me at this point. And it's true. I do just kind of want to talk about my kids. So like, it works out for everybody. Those jokes work better than other jokes. So I'll keep doing them. As long as my kids keep doing stuff, I'll keep telling people about it.
Why do you call yourself a weird dad?
It started as a, basically just because it's true, but it was originally, I was a weird uncle. So my special Good Grief is about the death of my younger brother, Mark. And I'm one of five kids. So my sister was the first one to have kids. So she had my nephews. And one day, Mark and I were watching our nephews. And I asked them, I was like, hey, am I the cool uncle? Right? I'm the cool uncle. And they're like, no, Mark is the cool uncle. He's cool Uncle Mark. You're weird Uncle Glenn. And I was like, oh. Okay. So I thought like I was the fun one, and they're like, no, you're weird. Like, we don't dislike you, but and talk about Star Wars an awful lot. We just want to go play wiffle ball with Uncle Mark. So he was the cool one. So I got used to being a weird uncle. And then when I had kids, I'm like, oh yeah, now I'm just a weird dad.
I got you.
It's also, if you listen to the Judge John Hodgman podcast, there's a category of litigant on that show a lot that comes up as just like weird dads with a system that they're trying to push on the world. And like, yeah, that's pretty accurate to me. They made a t-shirt for the show that says weird dad that I think my wife got me for Father's Day one year.
That's great. That's great. So it's a good title. If it fits, it has a great story to it in terms of how your nephews, if I'm correct, how that phrase would have seen both you and him. And then you adopted that now in terms of your life role as a comedian. It's a great way to have.
Yeah. Like if you ask my children, who's weirder, me or my wife, there's no contest.
Well, like, I'm looking at things like this. I've been to Austin, Texas, and they always like to keep Austin weird.
Yeah.
And that to me is outside the box, being creative. So I don't look at weird as a negative term. I always see it as a positive, open-ended term. Gives someone the ability to fit different categories, but not fit in just one. You could be comedic. You could be a father. You could, you know, be various things, a writer, a movie producer, et cetera.
My kids know that daddy's weird. They don't like I've hosted events for my kid's school a couple of times. So like she has seen me. She's too young for it for that to be the most embarrassing thing in the world. Like they did an outdoor carnival a couple months ago that they had me do a set at. So like she's out playing with all her friends and then everything's not, and they all like come to like the back of the pickup truck stage or whatever it was. And like, so she had to watch me tell jokes about her in front of her friends and their parents. And I'm like, that's in a couple years, this will be mortifying for you.
How did she react to that?
She was excited. She's like, oh, because she knows. She asked me recently what my job is. And I'm like, daddy's a comedian. She's like, no, I know you do comedy, but like for work, what's your job? And she just doesn't understand that this is my job. My 3-year-old, I just did my first like weekend of shows somewhere in a year and a half. So I was gone for a couple of days and I told her, I was like, oh, daddy's leaving. And then I'll be home on Sunday. I'll see you in a couple of days. She's like, what do you mean leaving? She's like, you're home all the time.
Not anymore.
Yeah. Like my wife's a librarian and her library has been open in some capacity for most of the pandemic. So she was working from home for a bit, but then going to the library to do like curbside pickup and stuff with people. So she's been going to work on a pretty regular basis the whole pandemic. But it started when my daughter was so young, she wouldn't have remembered before when, you know, like probably a couple times a month, daddy would go on a trip somewhere and be gone. Like she didn't remember that. And now that it's starting to happen again, she's like, what do you mean you're leaving? And my older daughter was trying to explain it to her. She's like, no, he has to go tell jokes to people. Sometimes he'll bring us and it's fun. I'm like, yeah, but it was the first show I did back was at a casino and children aren't allowed to stay at the hotel.
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh, you guys can't come to this one. But hopefully soon, you know, as things start to open up again, I'll bring my kids along with me places.
You're an entertainer.
Yeah.
I mean, I got booked to do a wedding, which sounds crazy for me to say that I'm going to be at a reception after someone gets married in the end of October as a psychic medium. But I'm like, all right, I'll do it
as a comedian. And it is just as weird.
Right. You sit there at the table like who side of the family are you from? I'm just a psychic guy. I'm local.
Yeah.
Here. I've done a couple of events and I'm not a comedian. I just read people. But it's kind of like if you can help show people something that makes their life lighter, if you could do something that makes them feel better, then I say as an entertainer, you're kicking butt. And that's great. And that's how I've noticed when I even read with people in large groups, I'll see that it's an entertainment kind of thing, but it's just me reading people. But for them, they're entertained, you know, like how that reflects. I wanted to ask you about Good Grief and share with our audience the story behind it and how you're able to turn something that's grief, which so many members of our audience have dealt with at different levels in their life, into a place of comedy and a renewal. And I find that amazing. I just want to see if you could share that with our audience.
Sure. So I mentioned in 2016, I recorded my first album. And then between recording it and releasing it, my younger brother, Mark, died in a car accident. And like immediately I started thinking of jokes. Like my mom called to tell me the news. And the first thought that I had was a joke about it. I didn't say it to her because that's not like you asked earlier if they've been like supportive and how they react to stuff. I asked my parents, I'm like, I either have to do comedy about this or I have to stop doing comedy and I'm not going to stop. So you need to tell me that it's all right if I do jokes about this. And she's like, well, I'm not going to tell you. No, I don't ever want to see it. I'm like, oh, no. Why would you? Of course not. Like, I get it.
Guess who gets the joke the best? Your brother.
Yeah.
And he gets your joke the best and he appreciates it, I feel. And I feel he's extremely immensely proud of you for what you're doing.
Yeah. My dad has come. So I did the show a few times. I mean, I did the show a lot of times, but a few times close enough to home that my dad came to it. And I told him, like, he's been very supportive. Wow. He's seen me do comedy more than anybody else. I'm like, you don't have to come to this. You can sit this one out. Because to me, it's different hearing someone tell jokes about their dead brother than hearing jokes about your dead son. He kept coming, and I every time I was like, you do not have to come to this. I'm not going to tell you can't, like, you're an adult, like, you can make your own decisions. But if I was in that situation, I 100% wouldn't want to go. But he did.
It's all about how you look at death, though. It's all about how you see death, right? It's how you look at death, how you see death, where you are with death. And I'm not saying that we should be celebrating death every day. No, I'm saying, but if you have the perspective that your loved one is still connected to you, that's where I'm coming from, my little lens. If our loved ones are still connected to us every day, and even though they go somewhere else, we can still feel them in our dreams. We feel them at certain moments of our lives afterwards. You can feel that energy. I feel a lot of us have those kind of things, and some people might be closed off to it, but I think there's enough coming through to let people know, at least this is just my point of view as a medium. There's enough coming through to let people know that we're not finally gone when we leave our body. So if you look at it that way, then your artistic expression of your relationship with your brother and going through the situation of what you've gone through, but being able to put it in a context that you can make people laugh about it and tell jokes about it, to me, that's the highest art form there is. The highest homage that you could pay to your brother is to create something in honor and to be able to share that message with others to help them heal, to help them look at grieving differently. That's what I get when I hear when I feel the vibe of what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, I had to start doing like touring it as a separate show because we were talking a little bit before we were recording. And I said, like, the reaction to the final special that I put out has been overwhelmingly positive. Like, every couple months I'll get like a random email from somebody who found it and they tell me how helpful it was in dealing with their own grief over something. I'm like, that's really sweet. I'm glad it helps. It was never my intention. I talk about it in the show. I'm like, I didn't set out to help anyone but myself. But when I started doing the material, if I was just doing a regular show, if I'm on a showcase, right, and there's five comedians, everybody's doing 10, 15 minutes, and I go up in the middle, I'm like, hey, I know we've been having fun, but death will come for us all. And it really grinds things to a halt. So I start the special, and the negative feedback I've gotten from the special is about the way that I started the show. For the most, like, a couple people have just been like, how dare you do jokes about your brother's death or whatever,
because why not? You're an artist. It's your expression.
Yeah. Well, the only times I've gotten that live have been when I've done the material outside of, like, if I was just doing a regular show and I tried to do those jokes, then some, like, I think twice it's happened where somebody will come up and be like, that's really insensitive of you. But when I call a show about grief and I explain up front exactly what's about to happen, that gives people a chance to, like, opt out at that point. They're like, well, I don't want to hear an hour of jokes about death and grief. I'm like, well, then why'd you buy a ticket to this show?
Exactly.
I stole it from Frankenstein, So the Boris Karloff Frankenstein movie starts with an old man comes out and like warns the audience how scary the movie is. He's like, if you stay, we're not responsible for any heart attacks or whatever. I forget the exact wording. I think he's the producer. I don't remember who exactly the guy is, but I basically do that to myself. I come out and I was like, look, this is a show all about my younger brother dying. If you don't want to watch that, now's your chance to just turn it off. And a couple people like left reviews where they're like, he says the name of the show so many times in the first 10 minutes. I'm like, yes, because I'm explaining why I gave it this bad name. Like, I don't think it's a good name.
Good grief.
Show.
It's a play on words, but I think it represents a lot of different meanings to a lot of different people. Now,
yeah, it's too wordy. It's a little like good grief is a little, I think I say in the show, it's a little first thought, which is a comedy writing term for like, you can do better.
Wait a minute. What's that about that? A comedy loss. I'll read you the title back at you. Yeah. Good grief. A comedy about loss and being bad at it.
Like, yeah, it's very long.
That's not long at all. That to me,
good grief is on its own. I don't know. Like, that's what Charlie Brown says. Like, it's not great.
Yeah, you know what? But it might be Charlie Brown, but then you put in the context and you have the description under it. Here I am. I'm an artist, and yeah, I'm writing this to express the loss of my younger brother to a car accident. And instead of, you know, burning under a rock and being depressed for 6 months, I decided to take my artistic ability, express my feelings and emotions, and put it into something that hopefully will let people get a different look at what grief's all about.
And I talk about some of the other titles I'd considered and why, even though I don't really like the title, I'm like, this is the best one for it, because it explains exactly what the show is. Because the times that I've done it, what'd you say?
What other titles were you looking at?
The worst one was Missing the Mark, because that was my brother's name. And I'm like, I had a list. That was 100% the worst one. The original show, I pitched it to a Fringe Festival in Scranton, Pennsylvania, with the title, I'm trying to remember the exact. It was something like How to Talk to the Grieving, semicolon, or How to Talk to Me Specifically Now That My Brother Is Dead. And I'm like, well, that's, again, it's too long. Titles should be pithy, I think.
Yeah.
Like, my first album is called Yes, Really, because that's usually, that's what I say when people ask me if my last name is really my last name. The Favorite, the new one that came out, like, it's just short. It refers to a joke in the special, but nice and short.
What is your favorite joke you've ever told and why?
That's a good question. So I do one where the joke itself is not funny, but I go to great lengths to get the audience to laugh at it anyway, which a comedian friend of mine, Jason Brown, a couple years ago pointed out. He's like, you don't really like to write jokes that audiences like. You like to get, you trick audiences into laughing at jokes that they don't think are funny. And I'm like, yeah, that's correct and awesome. Like, you should try it. It feels great. Cause it's so much harder. Like, oh, yeah. Oh, anybody can laugh at a joke that's funny. It's on my first album. So this is the joke. I had a dream last night. I was getting attacked by a bear. Don't worry, I'm fine. And that joke had never worked in like the first, I think it was 6 years that I'd done comedy. It's one of the first jokes that I wrote. And I really like it, but audiences don't. And it's too weird. It doesn't make a lot of sense. It was when I first started writing jokes, I was trying to do like Mitch Hedberg jokes. So in the same page on the comedy notebook that I bought when I decided to start doing open mics, that's on the same page as the first joke that I wrote, which audiences do like. And that's, my wife and I adopted a dog recently. We've been trying to have one naturally for about a year. And to me, those are the same. Like, they should work the same.
That works. That makes me laugh, right?
So to get the audience to laugh at the bad joke, I do this elaborate setup where I'm like, I'm going to do the first two jokes that I ever wrote. And I tell them, like, audiences really like one of them and they really hate the other one. I'm not going to tell you which one's which. I'm just going to do them. And I want to see if you guys can figure out which is the one that the audience doesn't like. So then I do the bear joke. They don't really laugh at it, but then they realize, well, that's the bad one. And then they laugh because they've found the bad one. And then there's a tag to where I'm like, well, what if that's the good one? Like, what if that's the joke that I think audiences really like? It's going to be a long, like 45 minutes or however long I have left on stage. The other ones, he's right here, actually. This is my daughter's toy robot.
Nice.
And he's got a little speaker in his belly. And I wrote a program that I can make him tell jokes. And they're all dumb robot puns. Like, if I just went out on stage as a comedian and I said, what did Robot Beethoven name his Fifth Symphony? And you're like, what? And I said, Diode to Joy. Like, it would at best get a groan. But if I tell you that, like, this is my daughter's toy, I bring him on the road because I miss my kids and I can't bring them everywhere. So he's like my little road buddy. And now my kids think that he travels the country telling jokes and I'm recording this show. So he's going to tell you jokes. You have to laugh at the jokes because I'm going to show the video to my kids. And if you don't laugh, you're bad people. You'll ruin the program. He can tell the dumbest robot jokes you've ever heard in your life. And you laugh at them because you don't want to be a bad person.
I love that.
Those are the most fun for me to tell because I'm like, I know on their face, these jokes are not funny or good, but I'm making you laugh at them anyway.
Exactly. It's an art form, man.
That's the most fun for me.
It's an art form.
Because then it does. It feels more like art than, I mean, I think comedy is art. I'm not trying to put down regular jokes. It's just to have that extra level of effort on my part to be like, you're going to hate this joke, but you're going to laugh so hard at it because I'll make you feel guilty if you don't. Like, that's just way more fun.
Within the context of our conversation right now, I'm dying to ask you this question. So just bear with me for a minute.
Sure.
What's the funniest joke you've told your mom and why?
Funniest joke I told my mom.
And how did she take it?
I don't run material by people.
Okay.
Like, I don't think of a joke. A lot of my comedian friends will be like, hey, do you want to get coffee and like write? I'm like, no, I don't. I'll get coffee with you because we're friends and you can sit there and scribble in a notebook, but it's not like comedians will bounce jokes off of each other. I'm like, I would rather just try it for an audience. Like, I don't care if my friend Jason thinks a joke is funny.
Gotcha.
But I remember, I think one of the reasons why I try so hard to do things like make audiences laugh at a joke they don't like is as a kid, I would read the Sunday comics like every week. I would like really look forward to like the new Far Side or whatever. And my mom never understood any of the jokes. And I would like try to explain them to her. So it would be like the Far Side of like, there's the famous one where it's like the whatever school for the gifted and the kid is trying to push on a pull door. And my mom would be like, why doesn't he just open the door? I'm like, because he's supposed to be gifted. So you would think he knows how a door works, but he doesn't. So it's the opposite of what you expect. And that's why it's funny. She's like, I don't understand. Like, from a really early age, I would try to like break down exactly what made things funny and why you should laugh at them. And then I also realized, like, I would try to explain like a Garfield joke to her and she wouldn't get it. I'm like, this one's actually not that funny. Like, Garfield, I don't know why it's lasted so long. Garfield's not funny. Far Side's hilarious.
I have to share something with you. The reason I ask that question, I get premonitions sometimes during interviews and I'm doing the psychic thing for a second, but I actually think you'll have content in the future you're going to talk about. And it'll be something titled "The Funniest Joke I Told My Mom and Why," or, you know, something you get in terms of your whole spiel. But there's a whole aspect of that you could get into that I feel like is going to be interesting to explore. I just rolled off you like your future self is telling me that that's probably something
we can make that happen. Like, I can start running jokes by my mom.
Well, it goes deeper than that, right?
Cry, laugh at this is the second time I'm bringing him up, but Everybody Loves Raymond.
Yeah.
She would watch that show and just cry laughing. And it would be the opposite of, like, I would try to explain Far Side Comics to her and she would just be in tears watching the show. And I'm like, I get, it's a funny show, but why are you laughing so much at it? Like, that's what I don't understand. Like, why?
Well,
that's
the thing about humor that so many people don't think about. I've had movies that I've gone to with friends in my lifetime where they're like, this is the funniest movie you're ever going to watch.
Yeah.
And I go to it and I'm like, I don't get the humor on this movie, whatever kind of movie. I'm not going to trash what it is. But then there's other people who go to that same movie and laugh so hard that they'll be like, you have to see that. I have a certain type of humor that I like, you know, everybody's got that. And I want to ask you as a comedian, because, you know, you get to see a lot of different reactions to your jokes across the different shows you've done. Have you ever found that people, you could tell different type people's types of humor in terms of the audiences you go to, the area in the country you're at, like different jokes fly differently in different crowds?
Yes. So I do, like I said, I used to be a substitute teacher. I have a lot of jokes about that period of my life, but it was a long time ago. So when I recorded my album in 2016, a lot of it is those jokes, because at that point I wasn't teaching anymore. I wasn't a full-time comedian yet, but I was starting to like get more paid work where it was less of a hobby at that point. And I'm like, oh great, like I can record these jokes and then I don't ever have to do them again. But then I started getting booked at a lot of colleges and I'm like, oh well, if I'm 19, I can probably relate to jokes about a substitute teacher more than if I go to, like, I'm doing some fundraiser event in Central Pennsylvania. It's like the town is raising money for their like 100th anniversary celebration or something. I'm like, that crowd, they might laugh a little bit at jokes about me being a substitute teacher, but like, unless they work in education, it's probably been a while since they've been in or around any situation that involved a substitute teacher. So they'll probably get the jokes, but like, I stuck to doing those jokes at colleges because I'm like, oh, these guys had a substitute teacher last year. Like they will relate to this. So even though I had planned in 2016, I'm like, let me just record these and I don't ever have to do them again. But then I started performing more and more in a context where I'm like, oh, well, these jokes will actually work better here than anywhere else I've told them. I generally work clean because to get booked at colleges, you have to do these showcases. Yeah. Where like bands and magicians and comics will all perform for like the student activities bookers of colleges in whatever region. So like every year I'll go to Hershey, Pennsylvania and perform for 1,000 college students. And then they'll figure out who they want to bring to campus next semester. And so I'll do, I know what jokes I can do there, but they tell you, they're like, you have to work clean. It's a 10-minute set. If you're dirty, schools won't book you.
That makes complete sense. I understand that. That would make
sense.
Then
I'll get to a college. I always ask at especially at colleges, but usually any show, I'm like, is there anything you don't want me to say or talk about? Because the way I look at it, I am not particularly well known. Like nobody. So
it's not like we'd have a show. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you wouldn't have a show that says Afghanistan.
Right. Like, if I don't think I'm at a point in my career where people are coming to see me specifically. Like, I look at it as a group brought me because they want a comedian. They want to have a nice time. So I'll do shows in like really rural areas of like, I'm close to Pennsylvania, so I perform there a lot. So I'll perform in like Central PA, where I'm like, I probably don't agree with these people on a lot of things politically, but it is my job to entertain them. So if I go out and I'm really dirty and offensive and I just go out and tell them how much I disagree with them and how stupid I think they are, they're not going to have a good time. And that's the opposite of what my job is. If I was really well known and people were coming to see me specifically, then I'm like, well, this is what you came for. Like, you came to hear me and what I think.
Me when? So,
what'd you say?
When you're well known? I work in those kind of mindsets that if you say, if I'm well known, I'll say when you're well known, since you're doing, you know, comedy and entertainment. I would always say, you just say when you're well known. It's not like you're trying to have a pompous ego.
I'm certainly better known now than I was.
But I'm saying, I'm applying the law of attraction to our conversation for a minute, meaning that if you should you want to be well known, you just think in your head that you're well known, and then eventually you get there. It's kind of like that I know it's just
Like I'll do a few shows where I know people are coming because I'm on it. But I also look at it as so like I generally work clean. I don't do a lot of political material because people don't necessarily come to a comedy show to hear specifically what I think, but I will, you know, I'll post political things on Twitter and stuff. And because if you follow me on Twitter, you've made the decision. You're like, I want to find out what Glenn feels like tweeting about. Like, you can just unfollow or mute me if you disagree. That's fine. But if I get, you know, if I get paid to come to your town and tell jokes that you will enjoy, I will do that. Like, I don't know. I don't want people to be mad at me.
I want to ask you, because this is my show and I can't ask this question. What would be your favorite political joke that you could tell on this platform that you couldn't tell in the college crowd or a central PA crowd?
I mean, if I could think of like good political jokes, I think I would probably do more political material, but like, I can't. Like, there's very funny political comics out there. My friend Jay Black isn't like a terribly political comic, but has like a pretty good political joke that I've seen him do a bunch of times over the years. And I'm like, that's pretty good. It's a pretty good joke. It's basically playing both sides against each other. Like, whether you're left or right, you watch that joke, you can be like, oh yeah, he really stuck it to the other side, when in fact he's just making it to
both sides.
Yeah. And I'm like, if I could think of a funny way to do political material, I would, but it just usually makes me angry or sad.
Well, so we're in some really uncertain times right now. I love having you on right now. And I really do feel that you are going to be when you're well known or when you're further known, because
I appreciate that.
And I'm not just saying that to encourage you, but I get information when people talk. So when you said, if I get when, so that's just something to tell you. I think your content, you're on the right track with your creative abilities, and you're not gonna be limited just being a comedian. You're gonna actually be doing your film production in the future, independently filmed production. I feel like you're gonna do some projects.
Yeah, I'm gonna be, hopefully, if things open up enough that we can like get a crew together that will do it, we're gonna be doing a short, hopefully pretty soon.
The guide you there, but I wanna ask you this, looking at the interview and what we're talking about today, and I didn't get a chance to hit this on for you, but in terms of what you're looking at, what's your personal view about grief now that you've been able to create good grief and you've put it out there and you've kind of gone through this journey that you've been through the last several years?
I think we should just talk about it more. Like, when I started doing the material, I think I already mentioned, I forget what we were talking about, but I'm like, I don't like it when people are mad at me. Like, as a well-off middle-aged white guy, I'm like, my biggest concern is just that people get upset with me. And when I started doing the jokes about my brother's death, I really thought, I'm like, people are going to be mad. Like, they're going to tell me I shouldn't do this. And it, like I said, it only happened like twice where strangers would be like, you should be ashamed of yourself. I'm like, well, it's not your brother. Like, if I went up and made fun of
exactly, else's it's not your grief, brother.
If I went up and made fun of someone else's grief, I'm like, well, yeah, that would not be a nice thing for me to do. But I talked to family members when I started doing this. Like I said, I asked my parents permission, but I also told them that they had to give it to me. And then I like told my other siblings about it. I don't feel like I needed their permission, but there's stories about them in the show. So I'm like, I told them, I'm like, my older brother, I'm like, I'm going to tell a story about when we got trapped at grandma's funeral with the praying nuns. Cause my grandma was in a rosary group in Florida, and the rosary group came up to New Jersey and like did the whole rosary around my grandmother's corpse at the viewing. And we got stuck in the room, cause they're like, if just out of respect for like the prayers and like, if we can just close the doors, we just don't want people coming in and out. So if you want to stay, stay. If you don't, now's your chance. And we couldn't get out of the room fast enough. And I started losing it immediately. Like,
can I say something for a second?
Yeah.
I have to say something funny, because this is just a Jersey thing. Bring on the nuns. bring on the, like, that's like putting you in the room and you're like, I'm not in any way making, I'm just saying from a comedic point of view. It's hilarious. It's like, wait, you had that moment and what happened?
Yeah. I just started laughing so hard. Like, and then the fact that I knew I shouldn't be laughing makes you want to laugh more. My brother, is just staring at me. And then like, finally the nun just go, hey, you guys can go. Like, we didn't have to stay the whole time. Cause I'm cracking up. Cause I'm like, it takes so long to do. Like,
how long would that have taken? If you think about approximately
the whole rosary, an hour, I think. Like, it's been a while since I went to Catholic school. So that I had to sit through it a couple of times. I'm like, it feels like forever.
I used to do it. I was a Catholic. I call myself Catholic light at this stage of my life, but I was, you know, I decided to do that in my 20s. So I used to do
Yeah.
That.
I always just say I was raised Catholic.
Yeah. But to do it when you're like in a room and you need to go, you're like, it's not a disrespectful thing, but we got to go. And then you're like,
right. I'm like, it's you either let me out of this room or you're just going to have to listen to this idiot laughing the whole time. Cause there's nothing funnier than a group of old women from Florida praying a whole lot around your dead grandma. Like, that's, of course that's hilarious. Who wouldn't laugh in that situation?
You got to have the humor there to understand it. If you don't have the humor, you're like, oh my God, I'm so appalled. You're so disrespectful.
Yeah. So I told my brother, I'm like, I'm going to tell that story in this show. And I'm like, I asked him, I'm like, is this how you remember it? And he's like, nah, I don't really remember it. He's like, I remember people praying around grandma and you were laughing for some reason. I was like, yeah, that's okay. That's
the reason. Yeah.
Like, that's, it's, he's like, I don't understand. Like, none of them told me I couldn't do it. So a couple people were like, I don't really remember it exactly that way. So I think I talk about it in the show where I'm like, my memory is famously bad. Like, it's not, I'm not the most reliable narrator for this story. So I basically did it where I'm like, if anybody who knew my brother watches this and they're like, I don't think it happened like that, I'm like, you're probably right. Like, you can take that away knowing you're probably right and I'm probably wrong, but it's just how my bad brain remembered stuff. Cause it goes back. I think my first grandparent died when I was like sophomore in college. And that was a long time ago because I'm old now. So I'm like, I'm not going to remember every perfect detail.
Keep in mind this way too. When you're telling your story and I was laughing, I'm thinking of that from the perspective of your age at the time. When you're like 12 years old, 13 years, whatever age it is that you are, and your grandmother passes and you're a little more disconnected from it as a child than you would be if you were your age now.
Oh no, I was like 25.
Oh, you're 25. Okay, fair enough. But I mean, there's different parts of how people look at things. How close are you to the person? How, you know, but there's right. all these other aspects of things too. But I think some people put death too literally, too closed off.
I do jokes about three of four of my grandparents' funerals. I did a joke about my maternal grandfather that I cut for time because of the four, like, it wasn't, the joke's not that good. But that was the one I had the hardest time writing because, like, I was really close with my maternal grandfather. And my dad's parents lived in Florida. So, like, we saw them maybe once or twice a year, or like we would go down there every couple of years. So, I mean, they were my grandparents. I loved them, but we weren't like terribly close. But my other grandparents lived in New Jersey. So we saw them all the time. And my grandfather was really into science. He was like a radio guy in the army. So he had all like this electrical equipment and stuff in his basement. So he would like teach me about electronics, and we would usually like make some kind of project when I went over there. So he and I were really close. So I had a harder time coming up with a joke about him dying. Cause that was like the first person to die that really hit. My grandmother, my maternal grandmother died before that. And I mean, she was my grandma. I was sad, but like I was a lot closer with my grandfather. So that one hit harder. And the joke I ended up telling about it wasn't about his funeral. It was like years later that my mom gave me my grandfather's accordion. And I don't play the accordion. And I'm like, thank you, mom, but I don't play the accordion. And she's like, but
He'd want you to have it.
Look at you and look at everyone else in our family. Who's the most likely to pick up the accordion there, bud? I'm like, all right, fair point. Because like, again, to the point of being a weird dad and weird uncle, I was a weird son. She's like, yeah, like you're just take the accordion, man. So I still have it. I've never learned to play it. The buttons confuse me. I understand the keyboard side of it, but then there's the other with just unlabeled buttons for days. I'm like, I don't know what to do with this.
I'll say something funny to that. As you're talking about your accordion, my mom gave me my grandfather's harmonica that I've never played.
I have one of those too. Yeah.
I look at it. I never played it. And I try to play on it. And it sounds worse than, you know, two cats outside.
It just seems so gross to play someone else's accordion.
Yeah.
Like its nature, you slobber all over it. He was a harmonica player. And he had, and he was an accordionist. I actually found years later, we got a bunch of their records and I found a record that he recorded. I forget the year, but it must have been when he was dating my grandmother, because he talks about he recorded it for his parents, and he between songs at one point, he talked about how he's going over to Annie's house later. And so I digitized it and I sent it to my family members, and they were super hyped because it was young grandpa. Cause like in the 50s or whenever he would have done this, like you could just go into a booth and record a vinyl record. So he would like play at restaurants and stuff. He wasn't like a professional musician. Yeah. He would just like go play out sometimes for extra money. He would always play for birthdays and stuff. He would play everybody happy birthday on the accordion, which that's about as far as I've gotten in accordion playing as I can do happy birthday. And it's,
I have to ask this because I know you have insight. Have you ever had a visitation dream or something you feel like where you have either your brother or your grandfather come to you in a dream or any other relatives? Because a lot of people don't have those, but I'll say that you probably do. If you do, you may not even realize it. Do you have dreams about them in the future?
I have dreams about people, but not like them talking to me, like all.
Well, and it could be indirect messages too. I always share that with people. So you could have a dream. Like I had a dream after my grandfather passed that he took my grandmother dancing, and I never knew they went dancing. And then I mentioned it to my grandmother and my mom. They're like, "Oh yeah, your grandfather used to be a prolific dancer when he was younger." And I started to take those breadcrumbs and piece them together. And then I figured out, wait a minute, my grandfather's actually communicating with me right now. This isn't just random statements in my dreams that I wake up and say, "What is that?" Like I'll actually keep a dream journal and I'll write down things. So that's why I was curious. A lot of times deceased loved ones come to us in our dreams. And especially when you're artistic and creative, you're rather also intuitive. So there's probably elements of that just to keep in mind in your future that you'll know about, even if you're not picking them up right now, you'll have that in the future. I feel like you'll have more connection to them both.
I used to have his harmonica on my nightstand. And I have somewhere near my nightstand, I have my brother. I took a couple things from my brother. One of them was a little poker chip set because we used to play cards together. That was like he and I weren't terribly close. Yeah. But, you know, he's still my brother. When he was in town, we would hang out and we would play cards together. So I had this set, and then my daughter asked, she's like, "What is that?" I'm like, "Oh, it's for a game that you play." And she's like, "Can you teach me how to play?" She was 4 at this point. I think it was a couple months after he died. So I taught her how to play, and like she was 4. So like, how are you going to explain poker to a 4-year-old? But I tried, right? And we played a couple of hands and she beat me every time. And like, it was a straight deal. Like I wasn't going to cheat to beat my 4-year-old. But I was like, you know, here. And then, so I would show, like, I showed her how the chips work. I'm like, when you win, this is what you get. And she's like, "Oh, so would Uncle Mark want me to have these?" I'm like, "Yep." So now that's how my 4-year-old got a poker set. I'm like, "Yeah, you know what? I think he probably would." So
that's a sign of what I call synchronicity in a way, like your little daughter playing poker with you when it was a memory you had with your brother. And even if you weren't that
so close when she starts card sharking all the kids at school, it's my brother's fault.
No, I'm just saying that actually is something as an outside person looking in, you're telling that amazing story. To me, that reflects the connection that your brother still has with you, that he's influencing you with the card deck with your daughter. That to me, that's how I look at it. Now, everyone looks at things differently, but I kind of delve into the spiritual realm a lot. And that's something I would see that as an example of. In other words, anytime there's similarities between what you're thinking of with your deceased loved one, and all of a sudden now you're showing your 4-year-old daughter how to play poker. I mean, there's a reflection there. There's a commitment there. That's great. I think that's phenomenal. I want to ask you this. Who's your favorite comedian and why?
Steve Martin, for sure.
Okay.
I get this question a lot in interviews, and then just randomly people like at shows. It's a thing people ask other comedians a lot. I don't really know why, but the answer is Steve Martin. He is my favorite because I think I already mentioned, I don't remember if we were recording yet or if it was before we started, but I used to watch the Steve Martin episode of The Muppet Show at my grandparents' house, like all the time. And I actually watched it again, coincidentally, last night. And it's great because we talked about how my favorite kind of jokes are where like the joke itself on its own isn't necessarily funny, but I will trick you into laughing at it anyway. Steve Martin does that a lot. Like a lot of what he does is just so goofy and pointless.
Roxanne. Remember the movie Roxanne that he was in?
Oh, yeah.
I remember that when I was younger. That was hilarious.
Like the stuff where like he'll have an arrow through the head and balloon animals. I'm like, it's so silly that anybody would laugh at it, but he's doing it so fake earnestly that everybody laughs. But the conceit of the episode of The Muppet Show that he did was he's booked to be the guest star, but then the show gets canceled because they accidentally double booked the theater to audition new acts. So he keeps coming out to like re-audition for this job that he already got. So he does balloon animals, banjo stuff. And like, I watched it so much as a kid where I'm like, it's really funny. Like I liked the Muppets. I'd seen other episodes of the show. I'm like, it's really funny that it's not really an episode of the show. Like it is, but they're like, sure. Oh, sorry, show's canceled. We're not doing it tonight. You guys can hang out if you want. And he just keeps coming out to like, try to get hired again, even though he already was. And then The Jerk, I saw that probably the first time in college. But other Steve Martin movies would play on like Channel 11 Saturday afternoon movie. I would watch a lot for some reason. Like as a kid, I said, I'm one of five kids. So we would all watch Saturday morning cartoons. And then my siblings would want to like, my siblings would want to go outside and play. I'm like, I would like to stay inside. Watching television. But at like 11 or whatever, cartoons stop and then they start showing just movies or whatever adults would want to watch at 11 in a Saturday afternoon. And it would be like All of Me or The Man with Two Brains, Three Amigos. Like those would all play pretty regularly. Yeah. Or Roxanne, like you said. I started watching Steve Martin. I remember in like third grade, we had to do a thing about what we thought we'd be like as adults. And I'm like, I want to have white hair like Steve Martin. And I don't. It's like, I found like,
you got years on you though. You got plenty of years to get lighter hair.
Well, he talks about it in Born Standing Up. Like his hair, he started going gray like pretty early. And I was like, oh yeah, that's what I want. And I have a couple like gray beard hairs, but I found maybe one or two gray head hairs at 38.
I want to ask you this. When you're looking at your life right now, where do you see yourself 5 years from now? And what would you be doing?
I will still be doing comedy. I think if I was going to stop doing comedy, I would have stopped by now. It would have been like after my first kid was born. Because I've been doing it for 12 years now, and you see a lot of new comics kind of come and go. There was I forget why we started saying this, but it's in an Army movie. It might be Saving Private Ryan, but one of like the older, like more grizzled soldiers is like talking to somebody else. He's like, don't make friends with the new guy. And in the movie, his point is, or no, it might be the book Red Badge of Courage. I don't remember where this came from, but they're like, don't make friends with the new guy because statistically they're not going to make it. Like the longer you've been here, the more experienced you are, like the more likely you are to keep surviving. But they're like, we burn through new recruits, and stand up tends to be the same way. Like a lot of people will come do an open mic because they want to try it once, and then that's the last time you ever see them. Or they'll come do it a couple of times, or they'll do it pretty regularly, but then they get married and have a kid and then you stop seeing them, or they get a new job or so. Like, a lot of people quit stand-up comedy, but I've been doing it for a long time through a lot of the circumstances that make people quit doing it, and I'm still here. Plus now, like, I've put out an album and two specials. I can't stop.
You can't stop now. You got to keep going. You already started the flame. It's burning, and it's going to burn.
My friend, I produced my friend Tyler Rothrock's first album, and he starts by talking about, he's like, I'm stuck doing comedy now because, like, I can't be the guy at the office with a comedy CD, right? Like, that would be so embarrassing. You start a new job and they're like, wait, did you used to do comedy? Like, oh, I can't. So I have to keep doing it. Like, I can maybe do it less, like, as I start to do other projects and stuff. Steve Martin famously, like, just stopped doing stand-up and went to do movies and plays and books and stuff. I would probably still do it. Maybe not as much.
It's in your passion. Yeah. It's a passion of yours. It's a lifelong passion. It's something that you're always going to do from now on.
It's so fun. Like, even if I end up doing something else, I will still do it. Like, I'll go to local open mics. There's people who do comedy not because they want to be professional comedians. Like, it's just like a bowling league to them. They're like, oh, Thursday night's the open mic, I'm going to go tell jokes at the open mic and have a couple drinks with my friends. And that's a perfectly valid reason to do it. I've just been lucky that I've been able to have it be my job for the last couple of years. And I would like it to keep being my job because it is more fun than other jobs that I've had.
Once you could take your side hustle and make it your main hustle, then that's like goal in life. Like, take something you're passionate about that you don't even feel like you're working to do, and you're doing it because you love it and you enjoy it, and you can make that your main thing. That's like,
it's weird because it happened kind of gradually where I started doing colleges more and those pay pretty well. So I was doing, you know, a couple a month for a while. And then I had this other full-time writing job and then that went away. But they gave me like a pretty generous severance package. So I was like, all right, I've got a couple months where I don't have to worry about money. I'm going to like really lean into trying to book more shows. And I've still done like other part-time work and other like side projects here and there, but like stand-up has been my main.
I think you're going to be able to do more of it as you go forward. I really feel that way very strongly about
it. I think now that the Dry Bar special is out, like, I've been very lucky to get booked frequently, but like, it's all kind of in the Northeast. But now that like Dry Bar is a national platform, so like I can call a club in Kansas and be like, hey, I have this Dry Bar special. I'm going to be in town next August. Like, what dates do you have? Like, they might not book me, but they'll at least get back to me now.
I love that. I think, you're going to continue to grow with that. I think you should definitely keep going is the words I get for you. Just keep going.
Thank you. Keep going
because growth is going to come your way. You're going to find success and you'll be able to eventually work towards other creative ventures for yourself, including some film. So I think you're going to start with small projects, but I still think you're going to be involved. I think you have a passion that's too strong to deny. And when you just have a passion that's too strong to deny, you're on your own path, your own journey. And I just
kind of you to say.
And I don't see failure as an off ramp. I see just a journey.
Yeah. To bring up poker again, like the term is your pot committed. Like I can't just stop. Like I can't just stop doing stand up now. Like I've done it for too long. Like the parents at my kid's school know I do stand up. I took my kid to
that guy. You're that guy that does stand up, but you're not that guy that works down the street that does stand up. So you're good to go right now.
Yeah. Like I got recognized at my kid's soccer practice the other night. One of the other parents was like, are you Glenn Tickle? I'm like, I am. And that can either mean that they were a former student of mine, but this lady was too old for that. Or they're a comedy fan, or they know my dad. Like I still get recognized just for being Bill Tickle's son at probably still more than I get recognized as a comedian. Like, are you Bill? Like, I look almost exactly like my dad, but with hair at this point.
We're running low on time, but I want to have you tell our audience where they can find you.
Sure. I'm at Glenn Tickle on whatever social media platform you use. I use probably TikTok the most now. That was a product of the pandemic I didn't see coming. But I use that a lot. You can go to glentickle.com. We'll have links to shows. Like I try to keep the show calendar on there updated as much as I can. It's got links to Jerk the magazine. If there's somebody that you don't like, you can mail them a magazine. I have one right here. We'll do the talk show thing where I hold it up.
I love that.
But yeah, we started production on issue 2 this week. So
I can't say that to anybody because they know you're on my show, and if they listen, they're gonna know I sent that to them. So I can't.
No, they'll just think those woman on the cover. Her name is Jen Winham, and she was a Kickstarter backer of the project, and she backed it at the level where I put her on the cover. Like I did it as a joke. I didn't think anybody would do it. Like they recommend you put like one very high reward level because it makes the rest of them look better. And like, who knows, maybe somebody will do it. And she did. She took me up on, she called my bluff. I'm like, if you back me at $500, I will put you on the cover of this magazine. And she sent it to so many people. And I'm like, you know, it's like, the point is that it's an anonymous thing. She's like, no, I want them to know. I want them to know who it came from. And like, I love it. I love her vindictive spirit. I did an interview with her for the magazine, and like, we've talked quite a bit now, now that it's out, and she keeps sending it to people. She sends me people's reactions to getting it. I'm like, this is incredible. Cause she's so, like, it's such a specific case because her face is on the cover. Like my name is in there. So like, it says, you know, I'm on the masthead, and people know I made it, but they're like, well, this lady's, why did this, even strangers who don't know her will see it and be like, why did this lady send me a magazine? I've never met her before in my life. The heat for me, I think.
Are you going to have some like investigation open up the post office as menacing content of funny magazine coming?
Well, I looked into it because I wasn't sure if you were allowed to send people mean things in the mail. Like, again, I'm so terrified of getting in trouble and people being mad at me. So I did a bunch of research, and then I found out Larry Flint sent a subscription of Hustler magazine to every member of Congress. And
you got to put in the context of, was it the 70s or the 60s when that happened?
I think he's dead.
Yeah. It's a while back.
So I think, I don't know if he still does it, but in his life, he sent a subscription to every member of Congress, and a couple of them sued him because they're like, you can't send us this filth when we don't want it. And the Supreme Court ruled, yeah, he can. You can send
pornographic.
You can send whatever you want to somebody in the mail.
Unless there. Like, yeah. You can't be like the, which serial killer was that sending explosives?
Yeah. Oh, I can't send like threats and stuff. Yeah, but I can send a magazine that calls you a jerk.
It's not considered obscene, and it doesn't appeal to the prurient interests of the general public, which would constitute obscenity under the statutes and federal law. So that's why you're able to send a magazine.
And the magazine, like the cover, I think the argument, it was over a year ago when I was reading up on it. The argument for the Supreme Court, they're like, you don't have to open the magazine. You can just throw it away. So like, even though inside the magazine, yeah, it's a porno mag. Like you can just throw it in the trash. And I think a lot of people who get this aren't going to read it. Like, so part of what makes it so funny to me is it was really hard making this dumb magazine. I spent a year on this. And I have to do 3 more of them now. But
You know what? I got ideas.
I worked so hard, and then so many people are just going to ignore it and throw it.
You need to reach out. There's a company that does fart spray or does something like that, where you could send something to somebody and it smells like that. You know what I'm trying to say? There's a humor side to it. You might want to gang up and get together and collaborate. Then you can have the
magazine. You can send like glitter bombs to people.
Would be like a care package, but in the opposite. I think that might go a little too far with people. Maybe the magazine's good enough.
It'll just be this and like fake dog turds.
That's funny. I want to thank you for coming on today and for sharing.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, what a pleasure. What a pleasure. And I appreciate it.
Very fun to talk to.
I appreciate you being able to take something as a topic like grief and turning it into a I always say turn the frown to a smile, like, you know, try to find the silver lining in something. Use your abilities, your gifts and talents to help others understand that you can laugh at different situations of life, and it's not meant to offend others. It's meant to express what's inside. It's meant
to let it out. I found in doing the show is so many people would come up to me after and be like, you know, I was at my grandfather's funeral and the funniest thing happened. Or like, oh yeah, when my uncle died, we thought of this great joke about it. And I was like, oh, so it's not just me. Like, everybody does. Like, I think I was so worried that people were going to get mad that I used humor to deal with grief. And then they're all do it. Like, everybody does.
I just want to thank Glenn for coming on the show today and sharing his viewpoints with our audience, to let our audience understand that grief is something that happens in our life, but it's not just the only thing that happens in our life. There's a lot of other things that we get to look forward to living our lives and doing what we're doing. And to be able to take a life experience and turn it into a force that you can help others laugh at and connect with and relate to, that's a power to me. That's a superpower. Having the ability to use your own talents to reframe something in your own life and connect with others who might be going through a similar circumstance, something like good grief, it just resonates with me. And I want our audience to check this out, you know, listen to this episode and think to yourself, sure, we all deal with grief at different times of our lives and at different layers. You might have someone real close to you die one moment, and then you may have a coworker's friend or a relative down the, you know, or a friend's relative down the street pass the second. It's how do we deal with grief? What do we do? How do we frame it in our minds? As a psychic medium, I will tell you that death is not the final step, that as you cross over, you transcend. You're greeted by someone else that's there, and you stay connected to us, and we're the reality show for the other side. So our deceased loved ones watch us. That's my theory, at least. And it's only a theory, but you can subscribe to it or not. I just think that what Glenn is doing is amazing. And I'm really happy that he's out there doing what he's doing right now. And I like his message and it resonates. So thank you so much, Glenn, for coming on. Thank you, audience, for checking out this episode and supporting our show. We just crossed over 160,000 listens and we're still going. And I just started a second podcast called Psychic Visions with my best friend, Megan Kane. And we'll be putting content out there as well. So keep in touch, check us out. And thank you so much. When you're positive, anything's possible.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Social Psychic Radio Show. Don't forget to join us for another episode next time. If you enjoyed the show, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give us a review on iTunes. You can also check us out on Facebook, and don't forget to visit the Social Psychic YouTube channel. Until next time, it's a big world out there. Keep an open mind, embrace your paradigms, and know that the universe is always yours to explore.
At Baker's, no matter where you order free pickup, you get the same great deals as you'd get in store. So you can save when you order during band practice, or at the dog park, or wherever. Start your cart with the Baker's app and save from wherever today. Baker's, fresh for everyone. $35 order minimum, restrictions may apply. Subject to availability.
Get more ways to save at the Buy 5 or More Save $1 Each sale. Just buy 5 or more participating items and save a dollar each with card. Baker's, fresh for everyone.
Welcome to Ringside with Ray and Prince. My name is Ray Leonard Jr.
Oh, we got this chair. No, that's just
my dad. My name is Prince Daniels Jr.
Daniels again with a big home touchdown.
On this show, we come to humanize
athletes, entertainers, business executives. We're going to see what makes them tick.
Tuesdays, 10 a.m. Pacific time on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, and wherever you get your podcasts.
We'll see you there. Peace and power.
Electric acid.
Welcome to Sara Talk Solutions. Ladies and gentlemen, you've tuned into a bit of a different type of show. I'm Sara B and I'm your host. You can find me on my IG, which is Aussie_Sara_LA. I talk about amazing, relevant conversations and topics and what functions that goes on in this magical, wonderful, wonderful city of the City of Angels. My IG, which is Aussie_Sara_LA.
Electric Acid.